Well, when you hear the voice of Ross Mitchell, you know it's time to take your phone calls. So that's what we'll do next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Jim Elvidge, and your phone calls. Jim, as you were putting together The Universe Solved, was there an area that you said, you know what, this could be happening to us right now? What special area do you think could be happening to us now?
Yeah, I think probably that was just the whole idea of the, you know, sort of nature of quantum mechanics and the way physicists tell us that our world is granular and, you know, that time chunks along like a computer clock, and that the resolution of reality is, you know, space is quantized just like, you know, programs are. That's really kind of the thing that hit it for me. And, you know, there are some experiments recently that were really fascinating. It happened over the past year. One is in Germany. There's a gravitational wave detector called GEO-600. And that was built to detect kind of like distant cosmological events, you know, black holes colliding kind of things, you know, real, you know, fabric of space-time changing events. But it has to be really, really sensitive because it's looking for, you know, deviations in gravity from long distances. Well, they've been plagued by a kind of noise that they can't find the source of. Well, the director of Fermilab, Craig Hogan, thinks that what's happened is they've reached the limits of space-time resolution, and it might be proof that we're actually living in a digitized world, living in a hologram, effectively. So, I mean, it hasn't been proven yet, but that's really kind of an interesting, you know, experiment. And then the other one that happened was in 2008, there was a team of physicists in Vienna who proved to this huge level, 80 orders of magnitude or something, that reality isn't real unless you observe it. So there's always been this debate in quantum mechanics about, is reality real? Is locality real? Meaning, you know, these entanglement phenomena where two things can be separated by, you know, galactic distances and still be sort of in sync. You know, one of those two things has to be false if quantum mechanics is true. And what they proved is that reality really isn't real until you observe it. And that's, you know, it doesn't necessarily prove that we're living in a programmed reality, but it can be explained easily by the programmed reality. So these are a couple of, you know, scientific experiments that really lend a lot of evidence and a lot of support for the whole theory.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Juan, welcome to Coast. Hi, Juan.
Good morning, George. I got a question for Jim. After one reads your book, and I know it's going to be a very interesting book, is one going to be able to use any time for reference or anything like that if somebody else is, like, writing the same topic or around that kind of topics?
Do you mean you using the book as a reference?
Yeah, because I have this book that I'm preparing to write, and I'm doing still the research all on it, you know.
Oh, great,
and,
sure.
And there's all sorts of, you know, authors you know, of course, when, you know, that's how you get the...
Just footnoting.
Yeah. You know, yeah, that's how you get the ideas to write books. And my ideas is, you know, similar to yours, except that mine is going to focus more on evolution of things, you know, how everything evolves. I've read Isaac Asimov and all these other science fiction writers and also nonfiction writers on the different topics, astronomy, the cosmos, physics, science, you know, chemistry. And yeah. I know a lot of people think that's who can read all those books, but, you know, when you have a job that you can do something like that with, have the time to read.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Juan. I hope it works out well for you. And it's not an easy book to write, Jim, is it?
No, it wasn't. I hope that it's an easy book to read. I've had people tell me that, you know, they were surprised that they could read it in just a couple days, that it's you know, fairly, you know, easy to read. I'm not a guy that, you know, uses big words and everything. So, you know, hopefully it's fairly straightforward. But to write it, yeah, definitely took a lot of research in a lot of areas. You know, there was the whole, you know, computational side of things, system programming, and then there was sort of the metaphysics aspect of it, and then there was cosmology and nanotech and physics, and all these things, you know, really had to be explained to lend support to the idea. So, you know, it was actually fun and, you know, really an interesting time to research it and put it together. I really, you know, enjoyed every minute of writing it.
Let's go to Anaheim, California, west of the Rockies. Hello, Albert. Go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
We're well.
All right, well, my question was that I'm going to get a little more into the spiritual side of it. You know, I believe that the real reality is heaven, since we're all ancient souls. And I believe that, you know, we live in heaven and we have jobs in heaven. And on occasion, we choose to reincarnate. And we're able to choose what planet we want to reincarnate into. And they say that Earth is the hardest one. It's the most difficult, I guess, schooling for God. And so when you choose to reincarnate, they say we write a life chart, and that indicates everything that's going to happen in your life. And every little part of your life, you wrote that in order for you to learn something. And so when you get deja vu, I read this book. It says that it seems like a familiar thing. People think that you dream about it, that you had a dream about it. So that's why it feels familiar. But what it is that you're remembering that part of your chart that you wrote before you came. So I just wanted to see what you thought about that.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Albert. You know, definitely this idea of the programmed reality fits in real well with those kinds of thoughts that you're talking about. Edgar Cayce, people who've done past life regressions, shamans, they've all come up with a lot of the same concepts, which are the same kinds of things that you talk about. There's a past life review. There's a, you know, meeting spirit guides. There's planning out your next life. And, you know, there's a great consistency to that story, which I find to be, you know, very interesting. How does it fit into this? Certainly possible that when you end your instance of the program, say you're, you know, I don't want to use the word playing because it's, you know, we're doing more than playing. But when you, you know, end your instance of it, you select what your next instance is going to be. You know, just like in a video game, you can be an ogre and control that ogre, or you can be a human and control that human. You make that conscious choice, and you decide what you're doing. Now, why do you decide it? You know, what is it that you're trying to achieve? You're trying to purify your soul, your spirit, those kinds of things, all very possible and all a little bit, you know, in a different different field than the book is in, but all fits in very nicely with the programmed reality idea.
Let's go to Los Angeles now on the wild card line. John, thanks for holding.
Oh, hi. Nice talking to you guys. How are you both doing? It's
sure
a pleasure.
Thing.
Hello?
Hello,
good.
John.
Yeah, hi. I had a question for you with the quantum computing. You know, when you do that, I hear that there can be a possible flaw, kind of like the chaos theory. That it usually nine times, I don't know what the statistics are, but say there's that one in a millionth or 10 million chance that it doesn't work out right. Do you associate that with black holes, possibly? That's my first question. I have one after that.
Okay. No, I haven't really thought too much. What do you mean in terms of, you know, associating it with black holes?
Well, since black holes could be like an interrupt in the program, because we're obviously not dealing with regular algorithms. So if you think of it maybe as it being a quantum computing computer, is that what you're kind of thinking of it as?
Yeah, actually, you know, I'm thinking that could be a mechanism. But I tend to think of quantum computing as, you know, as something that's a little bit, you know, different than sort of the, you know, linear computing construct. And, you know, that's what my background is. And so that's sort of the paradigm that I have in my head as to how this whole thing could work. But I imagine that once you know enough about quantum computing, you could probably apply the same kind of thing to it. Neural networks is another paradigm completely different than the, you know, the von Neumann computing mechanism, which could also apply to this as well. As far as black holes, it's a construct, you know, again, if this theory is correct, it would be a construct that, you know, consists of something that's observable, has certain properties, and, you know, exists in the space of the, you know, the construct of the program.
And have you ever thought of the idea that maybe every person, when they're born, is in their own program rather than one big program, and we are in our own unique program? Has that crossed your mind?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in the last chapter, I speculate a lot about that. Intersecting lifelines or non-intersecting lifelines. Imagine if you're in your own program and everybody else who's playing in your program is just a computer-generated entity, but other people can be in their own program. Imagine that it's possible that those sort of lifelines could intersect for a while. You're sitting in a, sitting around a table with some people, and boom, somebody's lifeline intersects. They are real, driven by a real entity, and then boom, they're gone, and now it's back to computational control. I mean, these kinds of scenarios seem to be possible to me. The interesting one is more that there are a lot of, sentient beings out there controlling their avatars, if you will. That seems to be more the interesting case, but, certainly possible that there are, quote, Agent Smiths in here. There are soulless robots running around. We may know a few. And all those scenarios are definitely possible. Some, none, all could be sentient.
Okay, very good. Next up, we'll go to New Jersey. Geneve, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you, George, for having me. All long-time listeners, they say. I like to say that magic is science undiscovered, and I will be sending, which is applicable to your guest, my existentialist tale of a haunted planet. For your guest, I appreciate your zest for philosophical thinking, because I'm a freelance philosopher, and I'm wondering if you've looked into Carl Jung, of course, because he talks about the collective unconscious. And he also studied UFOs and other paranormal events, such as psychic and all of it, actually. I think you would find that quite interesting. And, excuse me, I have myself had quite a paranormal life, but until I actually even was face-to-face with the haunted mansion, as I say, then I applied our physics to the orbs that we actually captured. So I also wanted to ask, I'm sorry, sir, you don't mention your guest name enough, George.
Sure, I do. I do it 14 times a night.
Oh, I guess I bought it. Sir, what is your name again? I'm sorry.
Jim,
I'm sorry. And with your subjective reality, reality with George Barclay, they call it radical subjectivism, is that you project, this is philosophy, you project everything that exists. It's all your thought.
We're going to need a question here, Geneve.
Oh, well, I'd like to say, with the quantum physics and your Heisenberg principle and the wave-particle duality and the fact that we are energy vibrating at, ferocious speeds, and black holes are actually, nothing can survive a black hole, I don't see how your theory is all that...
Come on.
New, profound. I mean,
all right. What do you think?
Okay, good. definitely looked into Jung quite a bit. I studied Jung in school, I think Jung's concepts are, from his standpoint, it was viewing things from a psychological bent, a mass consciousness kind of lens on reality, and then the Princeton pair experiments, basically were devices that were designed to, prove whether there was something to this mass consciousness phenomenon, which they pretty much did. What I'm saying is that, under program control, both those concepts are fit well into the paradigm. is this a new idea? It's definitely not a new idea. As I mentioned in the beginning of the show, people have been talking about, you know, reality versus dreams for centuries. So what's new here really is a couple of things. One is just a compilation of evidence from the fields of information theory, metaphysics, philosophy, quantum mechanics, you name it, just a lot of different areas that all add up to one idea that explains everything. I mean, you can come up with ideas that explain a UFO or explain anomalons in physics, particles that occur only when certain laboratories investigate them, or theories of dark matter or entanglement, all those kind of anomalous occurrences. You know, you can come up with different theories that explain each one, but you can't come up with one theory. This is the only idea that really explains everything. So to that extent, I think it is, you know, the compilation of evidence is new. Nobody's done that before. And the other aspect that's new is just the relation of quantum mechanics to the computational mechanism. As far as I know, that hadn't been done before either.
Jim, how did you throw Bigfoot into all of this?
Bigfoot to me is sort of analogous to the UFOs. It's another entity that can be injected into the reality that, you know, certain people can see at certain times and others can't. And why? Why would the programmers do that? Well, you know what? We do it when we create video games. We put interesting things in the games. Otherwise, life is boring. You know, there's nothing to investigate. There's nothing to get excited about. You know, I don't mean to diminish these things, but, you know, I think that there is something to be said for the idea that it just makes the program, the reality, much more interesting to have a variety of unexplained circumstances that people can ponder and think about and come up with theories about and, you know, develop those theories. If you think about how science works, you know, science is, you know, a never-ending process. You know, people have said in the past, physics is done. James Clerk Maxwell said, all we need to do is dot the I's, cross the T's back in the 1800s. Well, it was, you know, nearly true, you know, as relativity and quantum mechanics proved in the 20th century and as, you know, other things are starting to prove now. So there's always sort of like a Russian doll approach to life. You know, the more people uncover, the more they discover, the more theories have to be refined or the more new paradigms have to be developed. And so why? That could just be the way it is so that we keep playing the game. We keep, you know, living the life because that makes it interesting.
One of the hallmarks, of course, of scientific theory is testability. How do you test the program reality?
First of all, I would have to say that it's a great question. I'd have to say that it's not strictly a scientific theory. Your last guest there, Genevieve, was right. It's philosophy more than science. On the other hand, you know, how scientific is string theory? It's really more math than science, and that's not testable yet either. The second thing to say about that is, in some sense, if this were testable, it would kind of defeat the purpose of it all, wouldn't it? You know, so, you know, if it were testable and proven, hey, we live in a programmed reality, then everybody would think differently and act differently. So in a sense, it makes it a safe theory, almost impossible to disprove and very, very difficult to prove. That being said, there are a lot of things that really lend a lot of evidence to it, like somebody could do mathematical proof of coincidences. Mathematical proof of sort of the evening effect of life. These kinds of things, I think, would go a long way toward, if not proving, you know, adding a lot more scientific evidence to the idea.
Let's come back with final phone calls with you, Jim, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Linda Moulton Howe joins us with a series of incredible stories that she went out to cover, including a recent Colorado cow mutilation, an update on Africanized bees in the United States, and the mysterious crash of an object near Needles, California. Nobody reports it like Linda Moulton Howe, and that'll be our next program. Well, we're back with Jim Elvidge and on Final Phone Calls here. Jim, you make reference in The Universe Solved to Michael Cremo and his forbidden archaeology. Tell me why.
One of the things I tried to do is come up with as many anomalies, both sort of, you know, scientific as well as metaphysical, and to see how all of those would fit into the theory. And Forbidden Archaeology talks a lot about these out of place artifacts, things that are out of place in time, according to, you know, the time frame that the scientists tell us that things should exist. And again, in the programmed reality model, those things could easily be placed. You know, what they are is just, artifacts in the program. They're things that we can perceive. They don't have to have really been there that long. In fact, the program doesn't have to have been running for 13 billion years. It could have been running for 5 minutes or 40 days if you really get right down to it and think about it. So so those things can very easily be explained by this theory. And again, why would they be put there? Perhaps they're put there to make us think, to question reality, or to advance our thinking, to make us, you know, move in certain directions in terms of discovering, advancing our thinking, our scientific thinking.
The Matrix wasn't all that far off, was it?
Maybe not. I mean, you know, it's one type of simulation. It's the type where a simulation is sort of fed into your brain. That isn't necessarily the only type. Nanotechnology gives us possibilities of generating sort of physical simulations in 50, 70-year kind of time frame, according to a lot of the experts. So, you know, there's this idea of, I think you guys have talked about this on the show, foglets, swarms of nanobots that are able to, communicate with each other, sort of network like small intelligent computers, and yet they can fly and they can generate electromagnetic radiation in the visible light range where they could make themselves look like almost anything. So, you know, you're walking along, you don't see them, and suddenly under program control, they turn into a sofa or a different room. You could be, you know, cooking in the kitchen, and then you press a button, and the kitchen turns into a living room and then turns into a bedroom when it's time to go to bed. You know, these kinds of ideas have been thought about and put forth. And, you know, interestingly enough, if you follow the trends of nanotech, they're just heading in that direction. Like, you know, Harvard University created a robotic fly that was, I think, 3 centimeters in diameter a couple years ago, and now there's one that's 1.5 centimeters. And so that's following Moore's Law. They're getting smaller and smaller. There was another company, I'm not sure where it was, I think it was maybe in the UK, that developed a motor that could propel nanobots in the bloodstream to seek out, say, cancer cells or whatever. So nanotechnology gives the possibility of programming a physical reality rather than one that's simulated into your brain.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Toronto, Canada, we go. Scott, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Scott.
Morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And letting me inject some concepts or observations for your consideration. Instinct is what comes to mind. I've often said we're programmed. I watched my child or my children grow from knowing nothing to just seemingly learning things by what I would call instinct. Further, I think that probability and reality are possible proofs of a free will, because probability never really pans out in the short term. So that might prove that nothing is absolute, even with probability. Now, I experienced the ability to lucid dream.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what I would call a self-programming mechanism within your own mind. There's no real way to describe how or why it works. Excuse me, that would be Dr. Stephen LeBurge that started all that. A cat that is pregnant and carries its young around and finds a place to give them birth, it knows nothing about that. But the one thing that made me think about this the most was watching a spider make a web. Just got lucky and happened to watch it. It used its back leg to push the pieces together. It built this web, and I asked myself, how would it know to do this? How would it know that it needed to catch flies for food? How would it know how to catch flies for food? And then how would it know how to build it when it never had a mother or a teacher? So I'll listen offline. And
okay, a lot of comments there, Jim. Do you want to sort through that?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Scott, for staying up so late on the East Coast there.
Everybody does it.
Yeah, they do. Always impressed. So I think Scott's question is a really great question. The whole idea of instinct is something that I guess, you know, science is, you know, I don't know that much about it from a scientific standpoint, but my impression is that there's a little bit of hand waving that goes along there. They say, oh, well, that's an instinctive, you know, thing in that species. But, you know, he's right on, because where does it come from? Is it in the DNA? Is it in, you know, somehow passed along in the makeup of the brain, you know, that, you know, the DNA is designed to construct or whatever? Hard to say. But, you know, the one thing that I've talked about in the book that's just right along those lines is this idea of what do they call it? You know, whether something is genetic or environmental. So you take two kids, maybe two twins. They're brought up in the same family, so their environment is the same. They're twins, so their genetics are very, very identical, and yet they could behave completely different, and not just, you know, sort of. You know, obvious behavior differences, but their values could be different. So, you know,
sure,
they could go through a line at a supermarket and, you know, one's given too much change and one says, hey, I need to tell the cashier that she gave me too much change, and the other one would say no. Well, you know, where is that coming from? You know, that they both learn the same things in the family. They both have the same genetics, but those values come from somewhere, and they probably come from the soul. They come from, you know, the sort of deep-seated instincts or, you know, beliefs that we have that are beyond the corporal body, that, you know, that we carry with us from instantiation in the program to other instantiation in the program. And I think his comments about the cats and the spiders and babies is just right on.
By the way, I wanted to thank you, Jim, for your acknowledgement to Art and me in your book. It's very kind of you.
Oh, I hope you don't mind.
No, not at all.
Good.
Not at all. A little late for that anyway, huh?
Yeah, right.
I'm kidding. Lafayette, Indiana, we go. Dan, you're up with us. Go ahead, Dan.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you.
Sure thing.
George, you mentioned just a minute ago the Matrix, and I'm kind of echoing a question with that. A few years ago, there was the Deeper Blue computer that played the chess games, and I don't remember the name of the man that was playing chess against the computer.
Was it
Kasparov?
Gary Kasparov?
Kasparov, okay. At one point, he said he had set a trap for the computer, and I think at one point even accused the programmers of possibly cheating, because the only way the computer would have been able to work out the trap was not by just following the programming logic, but having to actually reason out what was happening at the time. And in that respect, you mentioned, Jim, the computer games from 20 years ago, and I'm wondering if computers maybe have gone even beyond where we think they are. And when you mention the programmed reality, I was curious to the possibility of the programs themselves being the programmers for the reality.
Yeah, good question, deep question. I know exactly what you're talking about with that that instance. The way Deep Blue was programmed, and I believe this is the case. Most chess playing programs, they think X number of moves ahead. Like they can look ahead,
right,
six moves, and then they calculate all possible, you know, instances of six moves and pick the best one. Except for at the beginning of the game, where they have pre-programmed some openings and things like that. And so what Kasparov was saying is, hey, you know, I came up with a 12-move trap, and it figured it out, so there has to be something wrong. And I don't know what the result of that was, but, you know, he was really kind of right on the money in saying that. But the question is, are computers becoming sentient? you know, are they kind of learning on their own? There's a couple schools of thought there. One is that, you know, computers can be programmed to learn. There are neural networks and different ways that systems can learn. We're seeing it now in kind of a large scale. When you go to Amazon and you buy a book, it tells you what other kind of books you might be interested in. It seems to know, you know what I mean? So, so they're definitely getting smarter in that sense, but are they really becoming sentient? And I have to disagree with some of the futurists about this, and I think that a computer will never be sentient because unless a soul can occupy the computer. I don't discount that possibility, but I just don't think, you know, on its own it can be sentient, because if you break it down, it's a mechanical, you know, process effectively. So, you know, at what point would it be sentient? Would it be a billion instructions per second, or, you know, a trillion? So it can't be like sentient just up to that point, and then suddenly you're not sentient up to that point, and then suddenly sentient. It has to be sort of half sentient. And if you work through the logic, then you have to say that the most simple computer, the Atari 400s of yesteryear, had to be a little bit sentient, and it just makes no sense to me. So I'm not of that school of thought. I've yet to be convinced through all the arguments that I've read about it that computers will ever be sentient, but they can certainly learn, you know, and they can certainly, you know, collect information and make more and more conscious decisions, and they can be programmed to replicate and, you know, and come up with algorithms and things like that. So, you know, they can get to the point where they're performing the same kind of functions as the human brain, but I don't think they'll ever really be sentient.
Garry Kasparov defeated Deep Blue in its first match, and then they upgraded it, and Deep Blue crushed him in the second
match. Oh, is that what
match.
It was?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And he claims that there was an intervention. But,
well, you wonder if maybe they knew some of his traps. And so maybe they programmed it to
be... Well, and they should.
That's what a computer's supposed to do, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You had mentioned Albert Einstein earlier, Jim. What do you think he could have done had he lived during the computer age and had access to computers today?
Well, he would certainly have the ability to support a lot of ideas through simulations and things like that. But, you know, sometimes I wonder if, you know, Albert wasn't just perfect for the time. You know what I mean?
You're right. He was perfect for the time.
Yeah, he had a different way of looking at things. He didn't have a brute force methodology. He thought in different ways than some of his contemporaries. And so would he really have been different with a computer, other than the fact that he could maybe, you know, support some of his ideas with simulations and evidence that way, and help, you know, kind of speed up his research, his creativity, I think, might not have even been enhanced by having help from a computer. Hard to say.
Then again, I wonder if he would have knocked down some of his theories.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I really wonder what he would think about some of the research that's going on now, like these guys in Vienna that we talked about earlier, and what they've come up with, because they're pushing on the things that were just so important to him, and he didn't get a chance to see it. It's amazing that they can do the kind of experiments that, you know, 20 years ago we thought, oh, it's impossible to detect other realities or to detect whether or not reality exists when you observe it. But, boy, they're figuring out ways to do it, aren't they?
Yeah, they sure are. Let's go to Los Angeles. Stephen, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, good evening.
Yes, sir.
I've been a programmer most of my life, and I've also been studying religion and mysticism most of my life. And the idea of programmed reality and the idea of the Matrix and so forth reminds me a lot of the Buddhist theories of reality, that phenomena is empty of inherent existence and so forth. And I know that myself recently, I've had some experiences with lucid dreaming where I've become somewhat conscious within the dream. And I've noticed that the reality within the dream, when you're in that state, it's indistinguishable from the concrete reality of the waking state.
That's true. It's almost like one and the same, Stephen.
And I was wondering if you had studied mysticism in developing your ideas.
Yes, Stephen, I did a little bit. Certainly not to a large extent. I probably didn't read as much about it as you do, but there's definitely, you know, great correlations in Eastern philosophies with some of these ideas. The idea of oneness in Buddhist thought, you know, reminds me a lot of Frank Tipler's idea of the omega point, which was also a kind of programmatic outcome of the universe. So definitely some great concepts there. And as far as like the dream versus waking, you're right. I mean, if you think about it, what's going on in your dream? Your brain is being told that it's perceiving certain things. Your brain is processing visual sensations, auditory sensations, sometimes smell, feel, all those kinds of sensory sensations. And in, quote, reality, you're experiencing those same things, but you think you're experiencing them really because the light is actually coming into your eye, as opposed to when you're asleep, your eyes are closed, the light is just an electrical signal in your brain. But, you know, how do you know? How do you know that what you're experiencing in reality is real? There's absolutely no way to know that. And there are a number of physicists who have also come to that conclusion, you know, reputable guys who have said there is really no way to tell the difference between dreaming and waking state. There's no way to tell if reality is real because it is really just, you know, a construct of your mind. So really interesting ideas to think about.
Indeed. A minute to go, Jim Elvidge, tell us about your book, where you get it, one more time, and your website.
Sure. Thank you, George. The book is called The Universe Solved. You can get it on the website, which is called theuniversesolved.com. And I encourage people just to go to the site, whether they want to buy the book or not. I've tried to make the site real interactive. So it's got a forum on there. It's a pretty lively forum. We've got a lot of people who post all kinds of things about artificial intelligence and cosmology, nanotech and transhumanism, you name it, all the stuff we talked about tonight. A lot of things that are happening, people will post things that are going on today. You know, somebody will post it and say, hey, have you heard about this? So it's a real good source of information, too. I have a little artificial intelligence up there named Morpheus. He's a kind of program called a chatterbot, and you can just chat with him. And, you know, so there's a lot of stuff. There's a powers of 10 simulation that shows the difference between reality and what a programmed reality might be like.
You did a good job with it, Jim.
Oh, did you play with that, George? Yeah,
absolutely.
I'm glad you did.
Got to run. Jim Elvidge, the book, The Universe Solved. For
Thanks,
Dan Galante, Dave Caprita, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until that day, that moment, be safe, everyone.